Slide 8. "How do you do, Mr. McTodd?" said Lady Constance with great amiability. "I'm so glad you were able to come after all." Smith wondered what she meant by "after all," but there were so many things about his present situation calculated to tax the mind that he had no desire to probe slight verbal ambiguities. He shook her hand and replied that it was very kind of her to say so. "We are quite a small party at present," continued Lady Constance, "but we are expecting a number of people quite soon. For the moment, Irene and you are our only guests. Oh, I'm sorry. I should have... Miss Peavy, Mr. McTodd." The slim and willowy female, who during this brief conversation had been waiting in an attitude of suspended animation, gazing at Smith with large, wistful eyes, stepped forward. She clasped Smith's hand in hers, held it, and in a low, soft voice, like thick cream made audible, uttered one reverent word. "Maître."
"I beg your pardon?" said Smith.
A young man capable of bearing himself with calm and dignity in most circumstances, however trying, he found his poise wobbling under the impact of Miss Eileen Peavy. Miss Peavy often had this effect on the less soulful type of man, especially in the mornings, when such men are not at their strongest and best. When she came into the breakfast room of a country house, brave men who'd been up a bit late the night before quailed and tried to hide behind newspapers. She was the sort of woman who tells a man who's propping his eyes open with his fingers and endeavouring to correct a headache with strong tea that she was up at 6, watching the dew fade off the grass. And didn't he think that those wisps of morning mist were the elves' bridal veils? She had large, fine, melancholy eyes, and was apt to droop dreamily.
"Master," said Miss Peavy, obligingly translating.
There did not seem to be any immediate comeback to a remark like this, so Smith contented himself with beaming genially at her through his monocle, and Miss Peavy came to bat again.
"How wonderful that you were able to come, after all."
Again this "after all" motive creeping into the theme.
"You know Miss Peavy's work, of course," said Lady Constance, smiling pleasantly on her two celebrities. "Who does not?" said Smith courteously. "Oh, do you?"
said Miss Peavy, gratification causing her slender body to perform a sort of ladylike shimmy down its whole length.
"I scarcely hoped that you would know my name. My Canadian sales have not been large."
"Quite large enough," said Smith. "I mean, of course," he added with a paternal smile, "that while your delicate art may not have a universal appeal in a young country, it is intensely appreciated by a small and select body of the intelligentsia." And if that was not the stuff to give them, he reflected with not a little complacency, he was dashed.
"Your own wonderful poems," replied Miss Peavy, "are of course known the whole world over. Oh, Mr. McTodd, you can hardly appreciate how I feel meeting you. It is like the realization of some golden dream of childhood. It is like..."
Here, the Hon. Freddy Threepwood remarked suddenly that he was going to pop into the house for a whiskey and soda. As he had not previously spoken, his observation had something of the effect of a voice from the tomb. The daylight was ebbing fast now, and in the shadows he contrived to pass out of sight as well as out of mind. Miss Peavy started like an abruptly awakened somnambulist, and Smith was at last able to release his hand, which he'd begun to look on as gone beyond his control forever. Until this fortunate interruption, there had seemed no reason why Miss Peavy should not have continued to hold it till bedtime. Freddy's departure had the effect of breaking a spell. Lord Emsworth, who'd been standing perfectly still with vacant eyes, like a dog listening to a noise a long way off, came to life with a jerk. "I'm going to have a look at my flowers," he announced. "Don't be silly, Clarence," said his sister. "It's much too dark to see flowers."
"I could smell 'em," retorted his lordship argumentatively.
It seemed as if the party must break up, for already his lordship had begun to potter off, when a newcomer arrived to solidify it again.
"Ah, Baxter, my dear fellow," said Lord Emsworth. "Here we are, you see."
"Mr. Baxter," said Lady Constance, "I want you to meet Mr. McTodd." Mr. McTodd, said the new arrival on a note of surprise. Yes, he found himself able to come after all. Ah, said the efficient Baxter. It occurred to Smith as a passing thought, to which he gave no more than a momentary attention, that this spectacled and capable-looking man was gazing at him as they shook hands with a curious intensity. But possibly, he reflected, this was merely a species of optical illusion due to the other's spectacles. Baxter, staring through his spectacles, often gave people the impression of possessing an eye that could pierce 6 inches of Harvey Eye's steel and stick out the other side. Having registered in his consciousness the fact that he'd been stared at keenly by this stranger, Smith thought no more of the matter. In thus lightly dismissing the Baxterian stare, Smith had acted injudiciously. He should have examined it more closely and made an effort to analyse it, but it was by no means without its message. It was a stare of suspicion. Vague suspicion as yet, but nevertheless suspicion. Rupert Baxter was one of those men whose chief characteristic is a disposition to suspect their fellows. He did not suspect them of this or that definite crime. He simply suspected them. He had not yet definitely accused Smith in his mind of any specific tort or malfeasance. He merely had a nebulous feeling that he would bear watching. Miss Peavy now fluttered again into the centre of things. On the arrival of Baxter, she withdrawn for a moment into the background, but she was not the woman to stay there long. She came forward, holding out a small oblong book, which, with a languishing firmness, she pressed into Smith's hand.
"Could I persuade you, Mr. McTodd," said Miss Peavy pleadingly, "to write some little thought in my autograph book and sign it? I have a fountain pen."
Light flooded the arbour. The efficient Baxter, who knew where everything was, had found and pressed the switch. He did this not so much to oblige Miss Peavy as to enable him to obtain a clearer view of the visitor. With each minute that passed, the efficient Baxter was finding himself more and more doubtful in his mind about this visitor.
"There,"
said Miss Peavy, welcoming the illumination. Smith tapped his chin thoughtfully with the fountain pen. He felt that he should have foreseen this emergency earlier. If ever there was a woman who was bound to have an autograph book, that woman was Miss Peavy.
"Just some little thought."
Smith hesitated no longer. In a firm hand, he wrote the words, "Across the pale parabola of joy," adding an unfaltering Ralston McTodd, and handed the book back.
"How strange," sighed Miss Peavy.
"May I look?" said Baxter, moving quickly to her side.
"How strange," repeated Miss Peavy, "to think that you should have chosen that line. There are several of your more mystic passages that I meant to ask you to explain, but particularly across the pale parabola of joy. You find it difficult to understand?" "A little, I confess."
"Well, well," said Smith indulgently, "perhaps I did put a bit of topspin on that one."
"I beg your pardon?"
"I say, perhaps it is a little obscure. We must have a long chat about it later on." "Why not now?" demanded the efficient Baxter, flashing his spectacles.
"I'm rather tired," said Smith with gentle reproach, "after my journey. Fatigued. We artists..." "Of course," said Miss Peavy with an indignant glance at the secretary. "Mr. Baxter does not understand the sensitive, poetic temperament."
"A bit unspiritual, eh?" said Smith tolerantly. "A trifle earthy. So I thought. One of these strong, hard men of affairs, I shouldn't wonder."
"Shall we go and find Lord Emsworth, Mr. McTodd?"
said Miss Peavy, dismissing the fermenting Baxter with a scornful look.
"He wandered off just now. I suppose he's among his flowers. Flowers are very beautiful by night."
"Indeed, yes," said Smith, "and also by day. When I'm surrounded by flowers, a sort of divine peace floods over me, and the rough, harsh world seems far away. I feel soothed, tranquil. I sometimes think, Miss Peavy, that flowers must be the souls of little children who have died in their innocence."
"What a beautiful thought, Mr. McTodd," exclaimed Miss Peavy rapturously.
"Yes," agreed Smith. "Don't pinch it. It's copyright." The darkness swallowed them up. Lady Constance turned to the efficient Baxter, who was brooding with furrowed brow.
Charming, is he not?
I beg your pardon?
I said I thought Mr. McTodd was charming.
Oh, quite.
Completely unspoiled.
Oh, decidedly.
I'm so glad that he was able to come after all. That telegram he sent this afternoon cancelling his visit seemed so curtain final.
So I thought it.
Almost as if he'd taken offence at something and decided to have nothing to do with us.
Quite.
Lady Constance shivered delicately. A cool breeze had sprung up. She drew her wrap more closely about her shapely shoulders and began to walk to the house. Baxter did not accompany her. The moment she'd gone, he switched off the light and sat down, chin in hand. That massive brain was working hard. Chapter 8. Confidences on the Lake. 1.
Miss Halliday,
announced the efficient Baxter, removing another letter from its envelope and submitting it to a swift, keen scrutiny,
arrives at about 3 today. She is catching the 12:50 train.
He placed the letter on the pile beside his plate, and having decapitated an egg, peered sharply into its interior as if hoping to surprise guilty secrets. For it was the breakfast hour, and the members of the house party, scattered up and down the long table, were fortifying their tissues against another day. An agreeable scent of bacon floated over the scene like a benediction. Lord Emsworth looked up from the seed catalogue in which he was immersed. For some time past, his enjoyment of the meal had been marred by a vague sense of something missing, and now he knew what it was.
Coffee, he said, not violently, but in the voice of a good man oppressed. I want coffee. Why have I no coffee? Constance, my dear, I should have coffee. Why have I none?
I'm sure I gave you some, said Lady Constance, brightly presiding over the beverages at the other end of the table.
Then where is it?
Demanded his lordship clinchingly. Baxter, almost regretfully, it seemed, gave the egg a clean bill of health, and turned in his able way to cope with this domestic problem.
Your coffee is behind the catalogue you are reading, Lord Emsworth. You propped the catalogue against your cup.
Did I? Did I? Why, so I did. Bless my soul.
His lordship, relieved, took an invigorating sip.
What were you saying just then, my dear fellow?
I have had a letter from Miss Halliday, said Baxter. She writes that she is catching the 12:50 train at Paddington, which means that she should arrive at Market Blandings at about 3.
Who? Asked Miss Peavy in a low, thrilling voice, ceasing for a moment to peck at her plate of kedgeree.
Is Miss Halliday?
The exact question I was about to ask myself, said Lord Emsworth. Baxter, my dear fellow, who is Miss Halliday?
Baxter, with a stifled sigh, was about to refresh his employer's memory when Smith anticipated him. Smith had been consuming toast and marmalade with his customary languid grace, and up till now had firmly checked all attempts to engage him in conversation.
Miss Halliday, he said, is a very old and valued friend of mine. We too have, so to speak, pulled the gowans fine. I'd been hoping to hear that she had been sighted on the horizon.
The effect of these words on two of the company was somewhat remarkable. Baxter, hearing them, gave such a violent start that he spilt half the contents of his cup, and Freddy, who had been flitting like a butterfly among the dishes on the sideboard and had just decided to help himself to scrambled eggs, deposited a liberal spoonful on the carpet, where it was found and salvaged a moment later by Lady Constance's spaniel. Smith did not observe these phenomena, but he had returned to his toast and marmalade. He thus missed encountering perhaps the keenest glance that had ever come through Rupert Baxter's spectacles. It was not a protracted glance, but while it lasted, it was like the ray from an oxyacetylene blowpipe.
A friend of yours, said Lord Emsworth.
Indeed. Of course, Baxter, I remember now. Miss Halliday is the young lady who's coming to catalogue the library.
What a delightful task, cooed Miss Peavy. To live among the stored-up thoughts of dead and gone genius.
You had better go down and meet her, my dear fellow,
said Lord Emsworth.
At the station, you know,
he continued, clarifying his meaning.
She'll be glad to see you.
I was about to suggest it myself, said Smith.
Why the library needs cataloguing, said his lordship, returning to a problem which still vexed his soul when he had leisure to give a thought to it, I can't... However,
he finished his coffee and rose from the table. A stray shaft of sunlight had fallen provocatively on his bald head, and sunshine always made him restive.
Are you going to your flowers, Lord Emsworth? Asked Miss Peavy. Eh? What? Oh, yes, going to have a look at those lobelias. I will accompany you, if I may, said Smith. Eh? Why, certainly, certainly. I have always held, said Smith, that there is no finer tonic than a good look at a lobelia immediately after breakfast. Doctors, I believe, recommend it.
Oh, I say, said Freddy hastily as he reached the door, can I have a couple of words with you a bit later on?
A thousand, if you wish it, said Smith. You will find me somewhere out there, in the great open spaces where men are men. He included the entire company in a benevolent smile and left the room. How charming he is, sighed Miss Peavy. Don't you think so, Mr. Baxter?
The efficient Baxter seemed for a moment to find some difficulty in replying.
Oh, very, he said, but not heartily.
And such a soul! It shines on that wonderful brow of his, doesn't it?
He has a good forehead, said Lady Constance, but I wish he wouldn't wear his hair so short. Somehow it makes him seem unlike a poet.
Freddy, alarmed, swallowed a mouthful of scrambled egg. Oh, he's a poet, all right, he said hastily.
Oh, really, Freddy, said Lady Constance, piqued. I think we hardly need you to tell us that.
No, no, of course, but what I mean is, in spite of his wearing his hair short, you know.
I ventured to speak to him of that yesterday, said Miss Peavy, and he said he rather expected to be wearing it even shorter very soon.
Freddy, said Lady Constance with asperity, what are you doing?
A brown lake of tea was filling the portion of the tablecloth immediately opposite the on Freddy Threepwood. Like the efficient Baxter a few minutes before, sudden emotion had caused him to upset his cup.
2. The scrutiny of his lordship's lobelias had palled upon Smith at a fairly early stage in the proceedings, and he was sitting on the terrace wall enjoying a meditative cigarette when Freddy found him.
Ah, Comrade Threepwood, said Smith, welcome to Blandings Castle. You said something about wishing to have speech with me, if I remember rightly.
The Hon. Freddy shot a nervous glance about him and seated himself on the wall.
I say, he said, I wish you wouldn't say things like that.
Like what, Comrade Threepwood?
What you said to the Peavy woman.
I recollect having a refreshing chat with Miss Peavy yesterday afternoon, said Smith. But I cannot recall saying anything calculated to bring the blush of shame to the cheek of modesty. What observation of mine was it that meets with your censure?
Why, that stuff about expecting to wear your hair shorter. If you're going to go about saying that sort of thing, well, dash it, you might as well give the whole bally show away at once and have done with it.
Smith nodded gravely.
Your generous heat, Comrade Threepwood, is not unjustified. It was undoubtedly an error of judgment. If I have a fault, which I'm not prepared to admit, it is a perhaps ungentlemanly desire to pull that curious female's leg. A stronger man than myself might well find it hard to battle against the temptation. However, now that you've called it to my notice, it shall not occur again. In future I will moderate the persiflage. Cheer up, therefore, Comrade Threepwood, and let us see that merry smile of yours, of which I hear such good report.
The appeal failed to alleviate Freddy's gloom. He smote morosely at a fly which had settled on his furrowed brow.
I'm getting as jumpy as a cat, he said.
Fight against this unmanly weakness, urged Smith. As far as I can see, everything's going along nicely.
I'm not so sure. I believe that blighter Baxter suspects something.
What do you think he suspects?
Why, that there's something fishy about you.
Smith winced. I'd be infinitely obliged to you, Comrade Threepwood, if you would not use that particular adjective. It awakens old memories, all very painful. But let us go more deeply into this matter, for you interest me strangely. Why do you think the cheery old Baxter, a delightful personality if ever I met one, suspects me?
It's the way he looks at you.
I know what you mean, but I attribute no importance to it. As far as I've been able to ascertain during my brief visit, he looks at everybody and everything in precisely the same way. Only last night at dinner, I observed him glaring with keen mistrust at about as blameless and innocent a plate of clear soup as was ever dished up. He then proceeded to shovel it down with quite undisguised relish. So possibly you're all wrong about his motive for looking at me like that. It may be admiration.
Well, I don't like it.
Nor, from an aesthetic point of view, do I. But we must bear these things manfully. We must remind ourselves that it is Baxter's misfortune, rather than his fault, that he looks like a dyspeptic lizard.
Freddy was not to be consoled. His gloom deepened. And it isn't only Baxter.
What else is on your mind?
The whole atmosphere of the place is getting rummy, if you know what I mean. He bent towards Smith and whispered pallidly, I say, I believe that new housemaid is a detective.
Smith eyed impatiently. Which new housemaid, Comrade Threepwood? Brooding, as I do, pretty tensely all the time on deep and wonderful subjects, I have little leisure to keep tab on the domestic staff. Is there a new housemaid?
Yes, Susan, her name is.
Susan? Susan? Well, that sounds all right. Just the name a real housemaid would have.
Did you ever, demanded Freddy earnestly, see a real housemaid sweep under a bureau?
Does she?
Caught her at it in my room this morning.
But isn't it a trifle far-fetched to imagine that she's a detective? Why should she be a detective?
Well, I've seen such a dashed lot of films where the housemaid or the parlourmaid or whatnot wear detectives. Makes a fellow uneasy.
Fortunately, said Smith, there is no necessity to remain in a state of doubt. I can give you an unfailing method by means of which you may discover if she is what she would have us believe her.
What's that?
Kiss her.
Kiss her?
Precisely. Go to her and say, Susan, you're a very pretty girl.
But she isn't.
We will assume, for purposes of argument, that she is. Go to her and say, Susan, you are a very pretty girl. What would you do if I were to kiss you? If she's a detective, she will reply, How dare you, sir? Or possibly more simply, Sir. Whereas if she's the genuine housemaid I believe her to be, and only sweeps under bureau out of pure zeal, she will giggle and remark, Oh, don't be silly, sir. You appreciate the distinction.
How do you know?
My grandmother told me, Comrade Threepwood. My advice to you, if the state of doubt you're in is affecting your enjoyment of life, is to put the matter to the test at the earliest convenient opportunity.
I'll think it over, said Freddy dubiously.
Silence fell on him for a space, and Smith was well content to have it so. He had no specific need of Freddy's prattle to help him enjoy the pleasant sunshine and the scent of Angus McAllister's innumerable flowers. Presently, however, his companion was off again, but now there was a different note in his voice. Alarm seemed to have given place to something which appeared to be embarrassment. He coughed several times, and his neatly shod feet, writhing in self-conscious circles, scraped against the wall.
I say,
you have our ear once more, Comrade Threepwood, said Smith politely.
I say, what I really came out here to talk about was something else. I say, are you really a pal of Miss Halliday's?
Assuredly. Why?
I say,
a rosy blush mantled the on Freddy's young cheek.
I say, I wish you would put in a word for me, then.
Put in a word for you?
Freddy gulped. I love her, dash it.
A noble emotion, said Smith courteously. When did you feel it coming on?
I've been in love with her for months, but she won't look at me.
That, of course, agreed Smith, must be a disadvantage. Yes, I should imagine that would stick the gaff into the course of true love to no small extent.
I mean, won't take me seriously and all that. Laughs at me, don't you know, when I propose.
What would you do? I should stop proposing, said Smith, having given the matter thought.
But I can't.
Tut, tut, said Smith severely. And in case the expression is new to you, what I mean is, poo-poo. Just say to yourself, from now on I will not start proposing till after lunch. That done, it will be an easy step to do no proposing during the afternoon. And by degrees, you will find that you can give it up altogether. Once you've conquered the impulse for the after-breakfast proposal, the rest will be easy. The first one of the day is always the hardest to drop.
I believe she thinks me a mere butterfly, said Freddy, who had not been listening to this most valuable homily.
Smith slid down from the wall and stretched himself. Why, he said, are butterflies so often described as mere? I've heard them so called 100 times, and I cannot understand the reason. Well, it would no doubt be both interesting and improving to go into the problem, but at this point, Comrade Threepwood, I leave you. I would brood.
Yes, but I say, will you?
Will I what?
Put in a word for me.
If, said Smith, the subject crops up in the course of the chit-chat, I shall be delighted to spread myself with no little vim on the theme of your fine qualities.
He melted away into the shrubbery, just in time to avoid Miss Peavy, who broke in on Freddy's meditations a moment later and kept him company till lunch.
3. The 12:50 train drew up with a grinding of brakes at the platform of Market Blandings, and Smith, who'd been whiling away the time of waiting by squandering money which he could ill afford on the slot machine which supplied butterscotch, turned and submitted it to a grave scrutiny. Eve Halliday got out of a third-class compartment.
"Welcome to our village, Miss Halliday," said Smith, advancing.
Eve regarded him with frank astonishment.
"What are you doing here?" she asked.
Lord Emsworth was kind enough to suggest that, as we were such old friends, I should come down in the car and meet you.
"Are we old friends?"
"Surely. Have you forgotten all those happy days in London?"
"There was only one."
"True, but think how many meetings we crammed into it."
"Are you staying at the castle?"
"Yes, and what's more, I'm the life and soul of the party. Have you anything in the shape of luggage?"
"I nearly always take luggage when I'm going to stay a month or so in the country. It's at the back somewhere.
I will look after it. You will find the car outside. If you care to go and sit in it, I will join you in a moment. And lest the time hangs heavy on your hands, take this. Butterscotch. Delicious and, so I understand, wholesome. I bought it specially for you."
End of side 8.